The latest edition of the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. All right, Stu, there was huge, huge NIL-ish recruiting news over the weekend. A very, I don't know if I would call it salacious story, but there's some crazy stuff going on, and you are actually the best person to talk to about it. Because it, for people who maybe aren't following this closely, as it relates to agents working with high-profile high school recruits, the one who's become the most prominent is a guy named Mike Cespino out of Orange County in California. You have covered him. You have talked to him for months. Mike Cespino represents Jaden Rashada, who is a top 50 overall ranked recruit in the 2023 class. Jaden Rashada on Sunday, he's a four-star quarterback out of Northern California, announced he is going to Miami. He picked Miami over, among other places, Florida, LSU, Texas A&M, Ole Miss. Jaden Rashada had kind of a wild recruitment in that he, and we believe it's kind of at the advisement of his agent, Mike Cespino, was doing a lot of trips to colleges, unofficials and officials, and was kind of showcasing. It felt like it was like a bidding war that was kind of at place. And then long after, probably a few later the night that it came out that he had committed to Miami, a story goes up on on3.com talking about the reports that the number of that Jaden Rashada got or is getting to go to Miami, I don't even know if it's the right way to say that, but that's how it's kind of the story was framed, was $9.5 million. And then he turned down significantly more than that from an offer from Florida. Now, there's a lot of stuff that is a little sketchy in this.
To put it mildly.
Okay. So, like I said, you've talked to Mike Cespino probably as much as anybody in the college football recruiting reporting space. What do you believe?
This is our story where it's not just Mike Cespino. You know, everybody you talk to has a different version of events, and you get off the phone and you can't help feeling like everybody is lying to you in some regard. Maybe some of it is semantics, playing the semantics game, but you just don't believe this stuff. I heard the same numbers that are in this story earlier that day. But I'm not going to go out and throw these, you know, huge numbers out into a story without definitive proof. And I don't think there is definitive proof yet.
Can I ask you this too also?
Yeah.
Let's stop there. When it comes to what you define as definitive proof, let's give our listeners, our audience, a little bit of a peek into what we see as what we would consider definitive proof to go with that number.
The only numbers I've ever reported on these NIL deals, and the first one was obviously the $8 million contract, and then there were three smaller ones, were deals where I saw the signed contracts. Short of that, I mean, I think the only way I would be comfortable reporting it is if, so this deal he writes in here is with John Ruiz, his company, the big Miami booster, his company Life Wallet is doing deals with all these Miami athletes. If John Ruiz is willing to say, but he's denying all this stuff, if he's willing to say, yeah, we paid him X, you know, to me, and then you've got the other side of it saying the same thing, then that to me seems more credible. But I still kind of feel like you got to see it in writing. Now, you wouldn't say, the interesting thing is, I was thinking about this, you know, you cover coaching searches all the time, and people tell you, like, yeah, Mel Tucker just agreed to a contract for X. You don't say, like, I got to see that in writing. Like, if the agent is credible, or whoever's telling you that, you know, you feel comfortable running with that. But this NIL stuff is so new, and so you just don't know what to believe, that I wouldn't feel confident just putting that out there. Because we do hear a lot of rumors about crazy numbers in NIL, and you just, nobody knows if they're true.
Right. And so in that spirit, and it comes to, you know, just a kind of a little window into how reporters work, at least in college sports, I feel like this is generally in most of the people I'm, you know, talk to or other reporters and even cover other things, is you basically have to develop trust with who these people are, who's a good source. You find out over time because you see their track record. I don't think you'd put out some huge splashy story based on somebody who you're not really sure of. In the case of Mike Caspino, I mean, nobody had ever heard of him in this space till a few months ago. And also, he has a vested interest in these numbers being big, because if the numbers are bigger, it makes him a more attractive potential partner for recruits and their families looking and say, hey, that guy got that big of a deal, I want to go with him, right? So yeah. I think that is something to keep in mind. Now, I would circle back to what I asked you a minute ago, which is, you know, we always have to be very skeptical in our reporting process. I think it's not an insignificant thing to think this through, and you and I have talked about this a lot offline, is, okay, somebody was like, the aspect of, if you had been shown a bogus contract, like, eventually that could get out. Like, I'm saying not get out on you, but I'm saying get out on the person who presented it to you in this case, if it is Caspino being an agent / attorney, there'd be a lot of really bad, you know, significant ramifications for presenting fraud. So I think when people go, like, I think what's realistic to expect and not expect, this is more than hearsay and what somebody tells you. Because even if a lot of times you'll see, you know, their stories get reported and it's like somebody's told you something, but they tell you it. It's not, the burden of proof is different than showing you it and seeing it. And there's a lot of stuff where it can be screenshots of things. I'm like, that could be, you got to be skeptical. I thought what also jumped out at me in that initial On Three story by Jeremy Crabtree on Sunday night was, not only did you have the dollar figures about what he was supposedly going to be getting, but also what Florida had offered. But then there was this incredibly damning quote that it's not an anonymous source. It is Mike Caspino blasting Florida and its collective, the most dysfunctional, you know, I've ever seen.
Florida is the most dysfunctional collective in all of college football, Caspino said. I plan on steering my clients away from them. From my standpoint, I never, ever want to deal with them again. If it weren't for the collective that's completely dysfunctional in Florida, he probably would have been there. All right, backing up.
Big HFS quote, if I've ever seen it.
And then, so he has this nemesis on Twitter, Darren Heitner, who was one of the early, I mean, he's been kind of a public profile for a while, but when NIL went effective July 1st last year, he was one of the first, if not the first, you know, representing athletes and getting these big deals. The Cavender twins from Fresno State are his clients, or they used to be Fresno State, now they're Miami. Basketball players, yeah. But he also works with the Gator Collective. He's a Florida grad, and he cannot stand Mike Caspino. And so as soon as this came out, with not only, you know, he's bragging about a deal that you would think, if this really happened, would be considered a blatant NCAA violation. But the you know, the shot at the Gator Collective, which I think, reading between the lines, is a shot at Heitner, just came back spewing venom. Here's what I think is happening to some extent. First of all, I do think he wanted to go to Florida, and it sure looked like Florida was the favorite. Now, there was a period a couple weeks ago where all the recruiting experts were leaning toward Florida, and Miami wasn't even really being talked about. So remember, he has visited Oregon, LSU, Ole Miss, Arkansas, Texas A&M. He's been all over the place. And then suddenly it became about Florida. And then, okay, here's a key detail. There was the week where the NCAA came to visit John Ruiz, right? The guy who's probably been the most out there about the money he's throwing around at athletes. And I think at that point, Miami went dark a little bit. And then the NCAA came, they didn't find anything, they're off, and suddenly Miami's back in it in a big way. And then remember, he was supposed to, here's the key detail, Bruce, he was supposed to, I keep saying that, he was supposed to announce his commitment on July 18th, he put out a tweet about it, and everybody was expecting him to commit to Florida. And then he pushed back his commitment announcement a week and used that week to go take a, I believe, 3-day visit to Miami. And at that point, you realize it's probably going to be Miami.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the hardest thing for us to do, and I feel like I have reasonable ground on this just from having covered and written a big recruiting book, I think it's really hard to predict what actually a high school kid really wants, where they want to go, what the circle, because so much of it changes from like week to week.
It's also unclear whether the kid is driving this or his father is driving this. His father, if you go to his Instagram account, almost all of his Instagram pictures, posts, are of these, you know, when they go to campus and they do these photo shoots, and he's in them, in some cases front and center. Like, it almost seems like he wanted to go to all these places for himself, right? To get wine and dine and take the pictures. And I mean, I've never seen a kid in so many photo shoots. He went to BYU, he went to Cal, he went to Ole Miss, I think more than once. And like, I just don't know if the kid himself would want, I mean, that's just an absolutely exhausting schedule. I remember at one point they visited Oregon and there was a notion that he was going to commit to Oregon right after the trip. And then the trip ends on a Sunday. And the next day, now he's scheduled an unanticipated visit to Florida. There's a lot going on there. I talked to Caspino on Monday.
One thing before, I think this is a fair point to jump in. So while all this was going out, Jaden Rashada himself posted this on his Twitter account. Any report regarding my commitment to the University of Miami is false unless I was interviewed directly. All reports of my decision involving an NIL deal is inaccurate. I would never make a life career choice for any monetary value. As I stated in my commitment live on TV, I chose Miami because of the relationship I have with the coaches, players, and the direction of the program is headed. I wish not to address the false reports again, as this is a time I wish to celebrate my college commitment and my commitment to my current team and teammates as we look forward to our dream of winning a championship. At this time, I request no interviews with All Love, Jaden Rashada. That is basically also coming on the eve of, as we're taping this Tuesday morning, Tuesday night here in Southern California, the Elite 11, where not only Jaden Rashada, but also Emory Williams, who's Miami's other quarterback commitment that they took, who's an in-state quarterback, who I know that staff seems to be pretty excited about. They're both competing in the Elite 11. And so I don't know if you'll hear any more from Jaden Rashada or his family on this week, but they will be around and we'll see what happens.
Which gets into another ethical question. You start out asking what burden of proof do you need? If you were covering the NBA and you got a scoop that an NBA free agent was go to X team for this amount, you wouldn't think twice about reporting it. If it's a 17-year-old college recruit, my thinking for the last week or so has been, I would feel really uncomfortable putting that out there if the player wasn't part of it, actively part of the story, wanting to participate. Because it's kind of his moment. And now, like, he had to put out that tweet because he's dealing with all these hate tweets from Florida fans. And obviously now he's kind of a target if he's really the $9.5 million guy. And it kind of, seeing that reaction kind of confirmed to me, like, yeah, that's really icky.
My feeling on that is slightly different, just in this regard. Just from, like I said, I've covered this a lot. Not the Rashada case per se, but just covering recruiting. My feeling is always, a lot of times you hear someone go, oh, he was a silent commitment for all the time. He's like, yeah, that's what he may be telling, this staff. But there's enough examples of recruits telling somebody one thing, and until they announce it, like, I've been in the room where coaches are expecting something to happen and it doesn't. So from that alone, I just feel like it's a lot flimsier than that. And I'm not taking away from what you're said, because I know it's definitely been awkward where there are times where I know that maybe some other reporters we're competing with probably know the same coaches, and sometimes coaches on their staff will basically scoop their own kid, their own player who may be committing, And it's happened a bunch of times where, you know, they will tell reporters, "Hey, we're going to get some good news here." And, you know, I don't know. I hear where you're coming from on that for sure.
It's interesting you say that, because the sense I've gotten recently, it used to be, I don't know how many years ago, that yeah, reporters would call the kid trying to get the scoop that he committed. What I've noticed recently is there are many instances where everybody, you know, all these recruits, they all know where the kid's going, but they kind of respect it and wait for him to put out his social media. Because these kids, like, that's their big moment. They've been waiting so long to put the splashy graphic up or hold the press conference or whatever. Now, maybe I'm being old-fashioned. Maybe somebody listening to this would say, hey, if they're going to make this kind of money, then they're basically professionals and you should cover them like professionals. You know, I'm open to either side of that argument.
All right, Stu, one thing we should like pivot to on this story is there's a lot of little tentacles to this, and we've all done some reporting on it since it's unfolded as well. One of the things I've heard from people I've talked to who also know Jaden Rashada is there. Mike Caspino is a very polarizing subject, and he's definitely made a lot of enemies, and you know, in a relatively short time around recruiting. And one thing that has come up is, if you are acting as an agent or a lawyer or whatever you are, shouldn't you be always putting your client's best interest first? So one of the things that the people I talked to yesterday were really disgusted about when it came to this story, and especially Mike Caspino, was they feel like if you're representing a client, you have to put their interest first. And they felt like Mike Caspino was putting Mike Caspino's interests above Jaden Rashada's ultimately, because let the kid have his moment. Instead, he is talking about Florida and he's going on the record, and now all of a sudden it's out there that he's not, you know, this kid is going to be the $9.5 million quarterback, and that's whatever he's going to be known at, because it comes right on the heels of this. And they felt like that was wrong. Where do you stand on that as somebody who's talked to Caspino a lot?
I mean, take it with a grain of salt, but he insists he did not give those numbers to the On3 reporter, that the On3 reporter already had those numbers by the time he called Caspino. But to your point, there are still all these kind of shocking on-the-record quotes. And I think the main reason it's all so shocking, if you're reading this, is why are you admitting to, like, if the kid has a deal with Miami before he gets to school, isn't that blatant, pay for play, right? We know the NCAA has, they don't have many rules about NIL, but one of them is no pay for play. One of them is no recruiting inducement. This seems to check every one of those boxes. In fact, in the story, he says, part of this that made headlines, frankly, was he said that Jaden Rashada turned down millions to go to Miami. That Jaden left millions on the table. Millions. He did not pick the highest offer. He went there because he loves Miami, the coaches, and the opportunity. And so you're like, what? Left millions on the table, did not pick the highest offer. This is everything that the NCAA is trying to put a halt to, and you're admitting to it on the record. So I asked him.
His nemesis, who's the lawyer who is the Florida guy, a University of Florida guy who is working with Florida and is very prominent on social media in this place, but, you know, accused him. He basically pointed the finger and said, there's yours violations, right? This on social media after that.
So here's some questions I asked on Monday. How do you respond to Heitner saying you violated NCAA rules? He has no clue what he's talking about. It's not an NCAA violation. He knows nothing about the deal. Is it an inducement? What is an inducement? His whole reason for going there is to win a national championship. That's his inducement. I've never ever had a kid pick a school solely because of the money, and most of the time they don't take the highest offer.
Solely because of the money. Solely
Right.
because of the money.
So you can start to see
A lot of semantics,
the semantics here.
working very hard here. Also,
We don't, here's another one before you go on. I said, well, where, because he's talk again, he talks mostly about Florida and this mystery $11 million offer. What is the process with Miami? We have a deal in process right now with a collective for Miami. We are in the process of a deal right now. The discussions did not begin until after his visit. I was very confident at the time of his announcement that we, at the time of his announcement is my words. He just said, I was very confident that we could get a deal done, and I'm still confident we can get a deal done, but we don't have a deal in place as of this moment. He's committed to the University of Miami to play football there. Everyone's saying we have a deal in place. We do not have a deal in place. So many semantics. One key thing is I think he's saying there's no deal in writing, right? There's no contract. Therefore, we don't have a deal in place.
There's no contract signed. Here's one thing that I think our audience should know, though. Mike Espino's contracts with colleges in regard, they have gotten around because he's been involved with a bunch of recruits. And so independent of you, like I've seen one of his contracts.
They all say in them, all parties agree, you know, there's an inducement clause. All parties agree that this is not an inducement.
Right, but it's one sentence that it's, quote, not an inducement. And there's a lot of people who have shown these lawyers say this will, they don't think this would hold up in court. Now, that's obviously not for you and I. We're not lawyers and we're not weighing in this, but that's some context. So I would not be surprised if Darren Heitner has seen Caspino contracts because, like I said, I've seen them.
Well, what Heitner is saying is it doesn't matter what's in the contract. It's the spirit of it. And it's so clear that this is an inducement. I would also note that, you know, another detail, right, is that he is strenuously denies that he has talked to John Ruiz about Jaden Rashada. And John Ruiz says the same thing. So you would be like, well, that doesn't add up. How could he have a deal with Miami if the lawyer hasn't talked to the booster who's making the deal? However, and this is I have two theories on why he feels so comfortable putting this stuff out there. One that's semantics, one that's more conspiracy theory. There's ways to do a deal like that where the two of them aren't dealing directly with each other, right? I mean, I've had things I had to DocuSign where the person who's on the other end of the DocuSign, I have no idea who they are, right? You're just sent a contract and told to sign it, right? So that could be one semantic. Part of me, though, just thinks, you know, I did a story a couple months ago where I quoted him saying the minute the NCAA, it was a story in response to the NCAA's, you know, new memo they put out reiterating or reinforcing that any booster contact is a violation. He said the minute the NCAA tries to interfere with one of my clients' contracts is the minute I sue them for antitrust. Part of me thinks he is begging the NCAA to come in and do something so that he can turn around and sue them and get all the publicity that comes with that.
Let's take it two things going forward. One, so this is a top 50 recruit. He's potentially the highest rated quarterback Miami's had recruited since Kyle Wright, by the way, another Northern California kid who ended up in Miami. The thing I would wonder about, we'll see how good he's going to be if he even gets there. I do think what is significant is it seems like the attention he is bringing, because this is a high-profile kid who has been all over the landscape of recruiting. For Mario Cristobal's program, I think there's a bunch of other recruits who may be more excited about Miami just because, oh, Jaden Rashada is going there. Whether he is as good as Dante Moore, whether he's as good as Malachi Nelson, Arch Manning, who knows? You know, there's probably as good a chance that somebody who's not in the top 10 of ranked quarterbacks may turn out to be the best one, because that's kind of how it sometimes works. But anyway, so there's that piece of it. The other piece, and we should talk about it a little bit, is Florida fans have, you know, I'm surprised, and I think you probably are too. Like, we both like the Billy Napier hire. Yeah. But I do definitely think there has been some sense of angst. And this didn't help it, because what you saw a lot of on social media, especially Miami fans, really Miami staff really embraced, you know, there's rock, the Rock pictures and like, you know, twisting gators and everything else like this. I mean, this was definitely rubbing their nose in it that it was, hey, he picked here over Florida. If you're a Florida fan, how are you feeling right now?
Yeah, it kind of caught me by surprise, because it's not like I follow Florida recruiting that closely, that there is a faction, and it's the message board faction, so take it for what it's worth, has already turned on Billy Napier, has already convinced that he's no better. Because what was Dan Mullen's downfall? He wasn't a great recruiter. They're already convinced that neither is Billy Napier, because it wasn't just Rashada. There have been a bunch of kids they missed out on. There was an offensive lineman this past weekend who took a visit to Florida and within a half hour of leaving campus committed to Florida State. So yeah, there's a lot of angst, and I think that last week, Bruce, he put out an open letter to Florida fans that people took as like his attempt to kind of fire back and stand up for himself. I'm of the opinion that what happens in June doesn't matter. You know, either he'll come out and they'll have a good team this year and everybody will jump on the bandwagon, or they'll go 5-7 and that'll confirm their worst fears. I would also say that it's very early to be jumping to any conclusions about anybody about how good a recruiter they are. You know, Washington, here's a better example. Kalen DeBoer got off to kind of a slow start in recruiting at Washington, and all of a sudden in the last week he's had like 5 or 6 commitments. These things can come in surges like that. But I think what's, you know, the Caspino quote you referenced, right, about how dysfunctional the Florida collective is and everything. If you're somebody, a Florida fan who already was feeling like this isn't going well, I mean, that's just fuel to the fire.
I would say this. I think Billy Napier was a good hire. I think he will prove to be an upgrade over Dan Mullen for the attention to detail, and I think he and his staff will recruit. I think he's put together a good staff. We'll see if Florida can pull another quarterback away. I mean, I guess one name to keep an eye on. You know, there's a Big Ten quarterback recruit who's also going to be at the Elite 11 this week, who has some Florida roots. That maybe that will be one that we'll see if that will be a move that they can make. I don't know.
I also don't think it's as high stakes as it used to be. Like the idea that we have to get a quarterback in this, we have to get a highly ranked quarterback in this class. If you don't get one,
you're probably more likely that your starting quarterback is going to be playing at someplace else that is going to be a transfer portal guy.
Correct. Miami, like you said, has 2 quarterbacks in this class. No chance they both play 3-4 years for Miami. And then the other side of it, right? If Florida feels they've got a void at quarterback after, after they lose Anthony Richardson, they'll go get somebody out of the portal. So, you know, I get it. Why we place so much attention on these. And this happens to be an absolutely loaded class for quarterbacks. I mean, I think there's 5 5-star quarterbacks. Some years there's only 1 or 2. So I get it. It's a big victory if you get one of these guys, right? I mean, most notably Texas. But if Dante Moore commits to Oregon, a kid from Michigan, that's going to be a big win for Oregon and a not great look for Michigan. But at the end of the day, like, there's other ways to get your quarterback. All right, other news, and actually in most occasions, this would be the lead story on the podcast. You know, Bob Bowlsby's retiring as Big 12 commissioner. They've been doing a search for a new commissioner, and they've apparently landed on somebody. And, you know, you thought George Kliavkoff was outside the box last year. This is taking outside the box to a whole new level. Tell us about what you've learned.
So Brett Yormark is expected to become the new commissioner of the Big 12. Now, I do think he has more roots in sports, not to college sports, but he was with NASCAR and he was an executive with the Brooklyn Nets for a long time before he went to be the COO of Roc Nation. I think everybody knows what that is by now. So that's an interesting move. So he was a guy that, from our reporting, that he wowed the Big 12 presidents and in the process, in the interview process, he's got, what I was told is, he's got a Rolodex like no other. This guy is a very, very well-connected, like he's super tight with Adam Silver, super tight with a lot of people who are very influential around the sports world and like the heavy hitter crowd. I was told he has, you know, a ton of energy and a lot of big ideas. And this was... he's 55. He is a guy from the Northeast. What's a little interesting, and Max Olson, who's very dialed, our colleague who's very dialed into the Big 12, especially, you know, we're like, a lot of this is very intriguing. I'm curious to see how he's going to fit and wanting to be in Dallas and everything like that. But I think this follows in the line of George Kliavkoff at the Pac-12. In terms of your talking, as you said, as an outside the box kind of hire, where a lot of us were thinking, okay, these are guys, or these are people who have more connections into college sports. Like one of the names that I had heard a bunch over, the last couple of months was Rick George, the Colorado AD who had been a baseball executive and had a lot of, in Major League Baseball and had a lot of roots in the Big 12 footprint. And there's a few other names that had come up who were more tied into, had college sports backgrounds. But I guess this guy just blew them away. And I think it speaks to, it's a big shift from where they were with Bob Bowlsby, who, I think we both liked Bob Bowlsby and respected him a lot. And he had kind of a tough job at times, often. But I think Bob Bowlsby was as close to college sports establishment coming from the AD route as you probably could get. And this guy, Brett Yormark, is very different from at least college sports, although, like I said, he has a lot of ties into professional sports world.
Yeah, I mean, for as long as I was covering the sport up until recently, the commissioners always came from kind of like head coordinators become head coaches. Commissioners always came from somewhere, whether they were an AD somewhere or whatnot, in the college sports sphere. Like you worked your way up the college sports landscape to commissioner. And you think about guys like Jim Delaney, Mike Slive, back to, t well, I'm going back to. Backward to the days of John Swofford, Tom Hansen, these guys who worked in college athletics their whole lives. And now, once this happens, we're going to see almost a complete flip where among the Power Five, you're going to have Greg Sankey falls in that category, and Jim Phillips falls in that category. But they're going to be outnumbered by a guy who came from MGM, a guy who came from Roc Nation, and Kevin Warren, who came from the NFL. And had no previous college administrative experience. And so each of them has a different background. Obviously, they're not all, it's hard to like kind of connect them. But I do think that, I think this is an acknowledgement that it's time to embrace reality. It's time to embrace that this thing is changing. And these guys that have been in it for their whole lives are fighting like heck to preserve amateurism, to preserve the way things have always been. And I think there's an increasing reality check that that's not how it's going to be. And so you want somebody who, I mean, this happened with Kliavkov. He came in from the outside and as soon as he got exposed to the way the college football playoff is run, the way the NCAA is run, I think he was kind of horrified. I'm sure that will be the case for this guy as well. They're going to be much more willing to buck from tradition. And I mean, this one in particular, I feel like is acknowledgement that college football is entertainment. And the athletes are already making money and they're probably going to make more money. And you need somebody that just is going to be okay with that and implement new and bold ideas rather than trying to preserve the way things always have been.
Yeah, I think one thing, and there's a name you did not mention in either of those categories who's kind of the in the middle somewhere, and that was Larry Scott. Larry Scott did not, he came from the tennis world and came into college sports without the roots of it either. I think what, and the tricky part is Larry Scott and I sat through probably as many of his press conferences as anybody. Kept on talking about innovation over like to the detriment of probably the league, right? So much focused on what I thought, especially the time he was there. Larry Scott's biggest issue to me was he often or too often didn't remember that the main thing is the main thing, and he looked at, kept on looking at a shiny object off in the distance. And so I think if And we, it's honestly, it's too early to tell where, Kliavkov's coming off a 1 year, and it's really hard even to put it in. Kevin Warren's tenure is just ramped up right when COVID hit, right? And so, and Jim Phillips, it's still obviously very early for him. So we'll see how these things are going to work out. But obviously, as you said, landscape's much different. Landscape is dramatically shifting in the Big 12. And I don't necessarily think you'll be able to define, like it's not, it won't be right to define this hire on what kind of TV deal they get, because I think they're not positioned well to get a very good TV deal, to be honest.
But that is what both those guys, Kliavkov and this guy will be, Brett Yormark, will be judged by, is to get in the short term. But Larry Scott, that's what he was hired to do. And for the first couple of years, he was a star. He was at the Pac-12. He did get them a big deal at the time. It was everything else that happened after that that did not go his way. And obviously the gamble on the way he structured the Pac-12 network did not go his way. So, yeah, I'm interested to see it. I mean, that is the number one issue for the Big 12 with Oklahoma and Texas leaving. What can they do from a revenue standpoint to stay competitive? Will they be closer once the dust settles? Will they be, they're not going to be Big 10 SEC, but will they be closer to the Big 12, I mean, the ACC and the Pac-12 on the revenue situation, or will they take a big step back? They won't be the AAC, but they could, you know, become fifth out of five. So I think that's what he'll be judged on. Speaking of the ACC, they put out their new schedule model on Tuesday. Very similar to the one you're hearing talked about with the SEC, although the SECs would involve going to nine games. The ACC may soon be the last one left that's playing eight conference games. But basically, you have three permanent opponents, and then the other 10, you play five 1 year, you play five the next year. So you'll be doing over a four-year span, you'll have a home and home, at least one home and home with every team in the ACC. Right now, they go 5-6 years without playing anybody. So they announced that, and they announced the primary opponents. If you're a diehard fan of one of these ACC schools, you're probably, you know, parsing it, who got screwed over, who got the best break, etc. I'm not as worked up about that, but I will say one thing that stood out to me immediately. Georgia Tech, who's struggling right now, somebody has to play Clemson. Somebody has to be Clemson's permanent opponent. It is Georgia Tech. And in addition to them, they get Louisville, who's usually a pretty strong program, and Wake Forest, who is a very strong program right now. I think they got it the hardest.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that's a credit. The fact that you say this is a huge credit to Dave Clawson and what they've done there, because I think if you had said that 2 years ago,
people would have been like, oh, what a break. They get Wake Forest.
Yeah, I don't know who you would like want to show up in that slot machine coming up. Like, where's the three traditionally worst programs? Like, right now, honestly, if you're Wake Forest, you probably got the best break because you got Duke, Georgia Tech, who's really down, and Virginia Tech, who's usually good, but they're, rebuilding. Yep. To me, that might be the best. I'm not saying it's three lemons coming across the board, but like relative to everything else, I mean, that's probably as good as you can get.
Jason Kirk put on Twitter about an hour ago before we recorded this, schedule difficulty based on the last 20 years of SRS ratings. I'm going to be honest, I'm not exactly sure what the SRS ratings are. I've heard of them, but basically some sort of power rating. Schedule difficulty, and sure enough, Georgia Tech, number one hardest. Followed by FSU and Miami, probably because they play each other. Then Syracuse, Clemson's number five, UVA six, Louisville seven, NC State eight, BC nine, Pitt 10, Wake 11, to your point. VT, Virginia Tech 12th, Duke 13th, and coming in with the easiest, based on the last 20 years, UNC. UNC's three are Duke, NC State, Virginia. I'm a little puzzled why the North Carolina schools aren't just playing each other as the three. UNC's got Duke, NC State, but then Virginia. NC State's got Duke and UNC, but then Clemson. And Wake is playing only Duke of the other North Carolina schools.
I'm sure there's a logic to it that we don't get, because it's like the one thing, the Pac-12 tried to keep it in the state of California, where you have four California schools. Obviously, there's three that are close, and then you have, Wake and Winston-Salem's a little further away, but I don't know why that is.
Ultimately, I think there'll be a lot more, if the SEC does go to a model like this, there's going to be a lot more intrigue over who those permanent opponents are.
You know what happens, what will happen with the SEC, is the SEC has more firmly defined, these teams are the powerhouses, these teams are the dregs. Whereas, the two programs that traditionally have been the dregs Duke and Wake Forest. Duke under Cutcliffe was respectable, and Wake Forest is actually very good now. So it's hard to flip it. Even like NC State, you know, NC State, I would argue maybe the best team in the league right now, if not they're the second best. And so, you know, when you look at 20 years, there's been some up and some down, but like, I think it's just, it's the ACC is just, you know, with the exception of right now, Georgia Tech, I don't know who I'd look at and say, oh, there's a program that's going to have a hard time winning four games. Maybe Syracuse.
I'd put Syracuse and Duke in that category for now, unless Mike Elko can work wonders at Duke. But in general, this is the interesting thing about it. So the ACC has now scrapped divisions. The Pac-12 scrapped divisions. The Big Ten and the SEC are expected to do the same. And I seem to be in this very small minority that is going to miss divisions. Everybody else is like, thank God.
Can you really rattle off without, I don't know if you're cheating as I say this, Coastal and Atlantic even still?
It took me a while, but yeah, I can do it now. You really want me to do it on the air?
I don't. I trust you.
Because it gives you a clearly defined, like, something to aim for, you know? Like, you're watching, if you're a fan of whoever, like, your goal, first and foremost, is to win your division. Now, I will concede that sometimes results in a mediocre team getting to the conference championship game because they won the lesser division, but I don't know. I always hear people say college football, why can't it be more like the NFL? The NFL is more, you know, less subjective. Well, that's how they do in the NFL. But in college, apparently we want to make sure that the two best teams play in the championship game. And that will make for, I would assume, better championship games. But I'll tell you, I think it's going to be a problem for instance, my alma mater, Northwestern, has reached two of the last three Big Ten title games. I think if it's two best teams, period, they may never make it again. It's going to be some combination of Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Wisconsin, maybe an occasional Iowa. Basically, you're going to see what's happened to the college football playoff happen to conference championship games. There's going to be a smaller pool of teams that make it every year.
Can I stop you right there and say this? This is not to untape, but It's exciting that we're talking about the actual schedule and we're talking about football stuff like this and things related to games, because as we're taping this, you're about to leave for a little while, not leave the Athletic, but, you know, go on a vacation for a couple of weeks. And when you come back, conference media days are going to be in full swing. And that means the season's really essentially here.
Yeah, I think because I've been so focused on this trip coming up, it didn't really dawn on me that how close the season really is. In fact, Big 12 media days are going real early, to the point where I will still be abroad when they happen. I'm getting back in time for SEC media days. But yeah, I mean, it feels like the season's still kind of far away. But the reality is, media day, it always feels like the season's close once you get to media days, and they're only a couple weeks away.
Yes, I'm excited to get down to Dallas. I mean, I'm actually going there before I go to conference media days, but that's a good sign. The season's close, and for all the other drama and everything else like that, once it feels like football, nothing quite like it.
So you're going to do one audible while I'm gone, and then we'll take 1 week off. We usually do around this time of year. And then when I'm back, and it's full throttle. So the emails have definitely petered down, I think, because we haven't been answering them regularly enough. We got to get back at making that a regular weekly fixture so people actually feel compelled to email. But I'm going to put out the call right now because I have a feeling you're going to need some emails when I'm gone. So send them to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And Bruce, we'll see you next time.